Welcome to the Southern Naturalist Podcast, where we explore the interconnections of nature by providing the listeners, you, an immersive experience of what it feels like to be on the trail with us. My name is M.A. Thomas, and this is my dad, Bob Thomas.
Greetings.
We are both professors at Loyola University New Orleans and naturalists, and we're fascinated by nature and all she has to offer. We hope to encourage more people to experience the healing power of nature and develop a stronger will to protect it as our home.
We want to excite you about venturing into nature and enjoying the outdoors. Folks in the South enjoy their experiences year-round, and encounters with plants and animals vary with the seasons. We have many stories to share.
This podcast is brought to you in part by the Loyola University Center for Environmental Communication. Dive deeper into the content we cover by visiting our website at lucec.loyno.edu to learn more about this and other episodes.
In today's episode, we're taking you to a very special place in the realm of New Orleans. Naturalists love it. It's called the Bayou Sauvage National Wildlife Refuge. It's 27,500 acres of National Wildlife Refuge within the city limits of New Orleans. And the beauty of it is, it's only a 30-minute drive from the French Quarter.
Yes. It's just a gorgeous place, right?
Just gorgeous, yes. And we love it, and we go there very often. Have a lot of our classes out there and the like. And the reason for that is that the biota is wonderful. It's got elevated boardwalks. It's got it's got restrooms, which is always important.
Always nice.
It's also got a covered area in case you're in inclement weather. But the biota is incredible. And we love making monthly visits there. I always encourage our Louisiana Master Naturalist Program participants to go out there once a month for an entire year to get a flavor for the changes that happen over time. And we'll get back to that in a little bit in this episode. But believe it or not, it's got an incredibly dense population of timber rattlesnakes.
I bet people don't know that. In the city limits.
Yeah, I'd say most New Orleanians don't even know we have rattlesnakes in the city.
Right.
But they're extremely abundant out there, and what you would normally encounter in other areas. And the nice thing is you're up on a boardwalk.
Yep.
You're an elevated boardwalk. So you people that see them out there actually see them down on the ground about 5 feet below their feet. But it's really neat to see something like that from a distance where you can watch it. It's such a rare event for most people. We have fall yellow flowers. It's a beautiful place to go in the fall because of all the yellow flowers.
Absolutely beautiful right now.
We have spring flowers. It's just beautiful with the thing. Actually, one of our favorite things to do as a naturalist when we're out there is to show people emerging plants that are just starting to come up from seeds and be able to identify those based on our experience, and then take people back later and show them when the plants are blooming, which is really a cool thing to do. And always challenging. You know, it's not easy to identify things that are coming up from seeds if you haven't been around them a lot. It's a wonderful place for wetland plants, and we do a lot of wetland plant identification and discussion and ecological significance in South Louisiana. So this is a good place for people to kind of cut their teeth with a manageable number of species fed. And then, you know, a place like that absorbs a lot of weather. And so when hurricanes come through or big storms and the like, these kind of places really absorb a lot of the pressure from those storms that normally would be placed in neighborhoods where people live. So we see lots of value in it. Anytime we're out there with naturalists talking about it, that's what we do. We talk about not only the natural beauty, the natural values, the human use of the area, but we also talk about how important it is to holding water during storms, during flood situations, to buffering storms when they come
Buffering's
in.
A good word, sure.
All of those things. And the beauty of it all, it's kind of Interstate 10 running right through the middle of it.
Amazing.
Which allows the casual driver driving from Florida to L.A. to drive right through a wetland area like that and just see how it looks in a wild area. Even they're in, remember, it's all inside the city limits of New Orleans.
Yeah. And the numbers that I found are that it's home to 340 species of birds.
And then, of course, during the winter, the ducks are here in large numbers on Bayou Sauvage.
And white pelicans.
And white
which
pelicans.
Which are gorgeous, and they're bigger than our native brown pelicans.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I shouldn't say native. The whites are native. They just migrate here for
right.
part of the year, right?
Exactly. So. They're here. They're native during part of the year. But they're also much larger, and they also feed totally differently. You know, they swim on the surface of the water and scoop their pouches down into the water to catch their food, whereas
different.
Brown pelicans circle over the water and then fold their wings back and dive in.
They're like a kamikaze.
They're kamikazes, no doubt about that. And but there are an awful lot of other winter birds that come down here, and Bayou Sauvage is a great place to see them. And then the spring, oh my gosh, the migrants, the spring migrants are coming through. You know, we do have the fall migrants, but they're not as colorful and not as easy to identify.
Right.
Whereas when you're out there in the spring, you get, it's like, sometimes the trees look like Christmas trees with ornaments hanging on them.
Yeah.
Beautiful birds.
Well, and some of the birds pass us over in the winter, but not in the spring. A lot of them fall out here in the spring, which we're going to do an episode in the spring about migration for sure.
Yeah. And then just recently when we were out there on a workshop, we saw long-winged zebra butterflies, which are really cool. And they've
gorgeous.
Just shown up in our area over the last couple of years and seem to be getting more and more abundant. And then, of course, Gulf fritillaries. Both of these larvae feed on passion flowers.
Mm.
And there's plenty of passion flowers at Bayou Sauvage, so you see plenty of these things
nice.
Year-round. And then monarch butterflies, of course, too.
Yep.
Don't
forget about the spiders.
Oh, don't worry.
Lots of spider species.
A host of spider species.
Nice.
Lots of variety, and we had some real good interactions just the last week, seeing things up close and watching them feed and that sort of thing. And then there are all kind of neat plants out there. And since we're often out there with our Master Naturalist class where we're teaching people for the first time scientific names and how to identify and things like that, two of my all-time favorite plants are out there that the scientific names, one of them is Cardiospermum halicacabum.
Always fun to say. Say it five times.
You can't beat that name.
What's the common name of that?
It's called balloon vine.
Balloon vine.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then the other one that's fun is Alternanthera phylloxeroides.
Mm.
And that's alligator weed.
Okay.
And there's plenty of it out there. It's an invasive species, but
it's everywhere.
It's part of our nature now.
Yep.
And then we don't see many mammals, but there's scat everywhere on the boardwalks. And that becomes an incredible teaching tool, trying to get people to identify who lives there that we don't see because you can see their remains in their scat.
Based on the scat.
That's
awesome.
It.
Well, there's so much we're going to cover on our nature walk today with our good friend and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Deputy Project Leader for Bayou Sauvage Urban National Wildlife Refuge and Bogachitta National Wildlife Refuge. He's the agent, Pon Dixon. He's awesome. So we head out to Bayou Sauvage, and as we get there, we realize that there's more damage than we could expect from Hurricane Ida. And this is an area, as Dr. Bob explained, it has been decimated by hurricanes in the past, and so there's still effects of and from Hurricane Katrina, which was 17 years ago. And so when you have some situation like that where the habitat is trying to rebuild, and we call this ecological succession. And so you see evidence of ecological succession. But one of the really cool things is when we have a hurricane or a storm that's massive in size and does a lot of damage to our plants in the fall, sometimes you can just see the evidence of the response to these big storms. And so you can go and look at the trees, for instance, and see new growth. The green is different. It's like the green of spring, of new leaves and new growth. And so it's kind of bizarre when you see that in the fall because you don't expect it. But that shows you that plants are resilient in a lot of ways. What doesn't kill them makes them stronger, kind of thing. So with evolutionary adaptations, they've evolved this opportunity or this ability to be able to respond by regrowing their leaves so that they can continue to photosynthesize until it's time to drop them, et cetera, et cetera. As we start walking down the raised boardwalk, we have a couple of reminders that this is an urban refuge.
Pond Dixon has been at the Bayou Sauvage National Wildlife Refuge since it began. He's played every role you can imagine there, and it is in his heart. And you cannot be with Pond when you don't realize how important that refuge is to him personally as well as professionally. And because of that, and because of his time in the saddle, he has contributed incredibly to the development of that refuge, and he loves it dearly, and he will continue to be the soul of the Bayou Sauvage National Wildlife Refuge.
And we're always curious how naturalists find their calling. Per usual, I got distracted by a spider web, but not just any spider web. Thank you.
prior to Hurricane Katrina just was a, I wouldn't say an almost tour forest, but it was probably somewhere in the 75 to 100-year-old range. We had actually a closed canopy here. A lot of live oaks, a lot of hackberry, or sugarberry, some people call them. And then a few cypress trees along the edge. Most of those were down, and those that weren't blown over were killed by the saltwater intrusion that came into this part of the refuge. And this boardwalk actually was kind of like uplifted and mangled and distorted. So we came back after Katrina and rebuilt the boardwalk. And of course, replanted a lot of trees here.
As Pon mentioned, the destruction of Hurricane Katrina completely changed this place. And you can still see evidence of that. We're walking through a relatively young forest with an open canopy, and it's letting sunlight in.
It really is impressive how this forest came back. It's a perfect example of resilience and ecological succession. And that ecological succession was helped by humans, because what happened after the storm, most of the trees were flattened. There were very few trees standing, and the ones that were standing were largely damaged. So what happened is that a group of volunteers and also the staff of the Bayou Sauvage National Wildlife Refuge came up with a plan on how to start replanting trees. And mostly what they tried to do was to put trees in there that normally occurred in that area. And they also took the advantage of eliminating, as they planted new trees, eliminating invasive species that had been a problem.
Like Chinese tallow, of course.
Like Chinese tallow.
Yeah, it's everywhere.
Right. And now there's still Chinese tallow there.
Oh,
there'll
yeah.
always be. You never beat them. But the thing is, there's a lot fewer now than there were then, and so they're keeping an eye on them as best they can. But it's really very impressive to go out there and see the variety of vegetation, how many different species occur there, of different sorts and different relationships, and how tall they are.
Yeah.
I mean, some of those trees are 40 feet tall after just 15 years.
Yeah.
So it's pretty amazing.
Cool.
As we walk down the trail, we see persimmon trees.
So ripe persimmon is orange in color, and if you taste it, it's got a sweet taste to it.
And we recognize persimmon trees, and we recognize the fruit, and we frequently see them out there. But then we talked to Pon, and he explained the significance.
Thank you. So we looked this up and read that, according to old-timers, as reported in the Farmer's Almanac, persimmon seeds can be used to predict the severity of winter weather. When you cut it into two pieces, the persimmon seed will display one of three symbols. If it's a knife shape, it will indicate a cold, icy winter where wind will cut through you like a knife. If it's a fork shape, it indicates a mild winter. And then a spoon shape stands for a shovel to dig out the snow. Now, fortunately, we don't worry about the knife or the spoon shape here because we rarely get cold, icy winters or even snow here. So the fork shape is more applicable here. But look, that's a great example of TEK. The seeds that we tried to open were too dry, but Pond still had a story about it and still was able to tell us about it. So it's definitely something that we as naturalists will try to do the next time we see a persimmon seed.
it always helps to understand the history of an area. And if you just go back a mere 2,500 years ago, this was open blue water like Destin, Florida is today. And then the river was, at the time, was swinging back and forth and laying down the delta that we all consider part of the place we live. And so that got covered up with mud and a lot of sediment and everything, and vegetation started growing. And it was a marsh. And then there were people that came in, cultures that we don't even know what they call themselves, but the Chifuncta and Marksville cultures occupied the land and came in and started feeding there and living there and moving in and out and migrating in and out at different seasons and the like. For a long time, that's the only human use of that land.
Actually, the refuge is on the ancestral lands of the Chifuncta culture, whose villages were here hundreds of years BCE. And then later, as the story goes, the Chapatulas, or river people, and later the Choctaws.
Yeah. Interesting story, though, that a lot of people talk about the Chapatulas Native Americans, and the reality is that that is not the name of the people. That is something that another, when the early explorers came here, they stopped in some villages in what is now Metairie, a suburb of New Orleans, and enjoyed fellowship with them. And then after they went down by the river and met people down there, they came back and they said, "We didn't catch their names. Who are they?" And the people in the village said, "Oh, they're the Chapatulas." And so it was written down in their journals that that was the name of their people, like equivalent to Choctaw and Attakapaw and things like that. And the reality is that what the people in the Metairie area, the now Metairie area, were saying was, "Those are the Chapatulas," and what that word means is the people that live by the river. Because that's where they live. So, you know, sometimes our early history of the natives is weak.
It's our interpretation.
It's our interpretation, right. Of course. And then as New Orleans was founded in 1718, and as it started to grow, people started to venture out that way. And, yeah, there were people that were going out there and trapping and the like, but there weren't major developments out there, and there weren't major uses of that land. But over time, people started eyeing it as a source of income and a source of development. And so a lot of the land was sold at really cheaply, at 50 cents an acre, 25 cents an acre, to people who were just interested in seeing what they might speculate. There were a lot of people wanting to do agriculture on land like that, if they could drain it and turn it into agricultural land. And that happened all over South Louisiana. Back in the 18 and early 1900s. But eventually it was bought up by some people who wanted to actually develop it into urban living areas, like neighborhoods and suburbs and the like. And the first one had an interesting name. They decided they were going to build a place called Pontchartrain New Town In Town. And it would be a big neighborhood development. And that quickly turned into something that was called Orlandia, which was using the same game plan, but that's what it was going to be called, Orlandia. And it was owned by Clint Murchison, who, as most people know, it was the owner of the Dallas Cowboys. And actually, he had a silent partner that most people don't know about, and that was Lady Bird Johnson.
Oh, cool.
And so they bought the land, and the whole idea, again, was to develop Orlandia. And what they did was that they started clearing the land and draining the land. And one of my very good friends was in charge of that development project, and I knew him well, and he came by. I was the director of the Nature Center in Eastern New Orleans, which was closer into the city, and he would come very often at the end of a work day to tell me stories about timber rattlesnakes that were 7 feet long and as big around as my leg and things like that. But they had huge bulldozers and huge trucks and all the clearing materials, and they were cutting down the forest as fast as they could to get into development. But what they knew this, but they thought they could out-engineer it. The place was mostly peat soils, highly organic soils. and their bulldozers would bog down. Some of them sank all the way up to the top of the bulldozer, and they'd have to bring in heavy equipment to get them out. But they persevered. They thought they could do this, and they kept draining and doing everything they could. And finally, they realized this ain't working. Everybody was talking about it, and a lot of environmental people were starting to talk about how wouldn't it be great if we could set this aside as a refuge and wouldn't have to develop it because it's not developable in modern sense. And but I think a lot of us probably thought, yeah, big deal, that's really going to happen. Probably not. We thought that the city would probably be totally against it because it would take it permanently out of the tax rolls. We had a mayor, Sidney Barthelemy, who thought that could work, and we in the chamber. We were worried about the Chamber of Commerce. I happened to be chairman at the time of the East New Orleans Chamber of Commerce. I brought it up, and people bought into it rapidly, thinking a major government agency like this coming into town would be a good thing. It could be a big draw for more tourism in New Orleans, and. And then we got some other environmental people involved who worked with the environmental groups in town to make sure that everybody was on the same page. As it got near fruition, another beast raised its head in that somebody convinced the mayor that, you know, that piece of land out there that's next to the lake would make a great national, international airport. We could move the airport that we have now, which is actually in another incorporated city, west of New Orleans, a suburb.
Into New Orleans.
We could move it into New Orleans. The complete tax base would be here. That started moving real fast. Immediately, we were told by the Fish and Wildlife Service, if they build that airport, we can't do a refuge because there are federal laws about having airports near federal refuges because we attract birds. That's not good for airports. And everybody got very nervous about it. Time passed, and the mayor bought back into the project, and the rest is history.
Wow.
It became a refuge, and now it's expanded from 19,000 acres to 27,500 acres, and it is a major facility in our city.
Yep.
But we also had a lot of other players, a guy named Joe Madere that was mentioned earlier. Joe, when I met Joe, he was a police officer in the NOPD, and his job was to, he would go out and take alligators out of people's yards when they were in their yard and take them out and let them go in the swamp. People called him Alligator Joe, but he was a fascinating guy, and he actually lived where the refuge is now, and so everybody gravitated to him for advice. He retired from the NOPD, and he started working for these different entities, and because he knew it like the back of his hand, he grew up there, and he was in his, I guess, late 60s at the time, and he was a key player because he gave everybody advice, and he loved the land, and he wanted to see this refuge more than anything else. And then there were a bunch of us, like at my nature center, we were doing canoe trips out there even when it was under private ownership. We got permission to go out. We'd take people out all the time to see ducks in the winter, to see plants and wildlife and stuff like that. So we already had an educational tradition out there. And then lots of people like the Sierra Club would sponsor outings, and Orleans Audubon Society would take people out there to birdwatch. There were a lot of different groups like that that were engaged. So it just became part of the culture of New Orleans, even before it was a reality. And we got very lucky that when we had the public hearings, We had a bunch of great people who came out who really care about the environment to give talks and to urge the senators that were hosting the congressional hearing that we needed this more than anything else. And luckily, our senators jumped on board. A bunch of our congressmen jumped on board, and the city got behind it, and it is a reality, and it's wonderful.
Yep, it's a wonderful place. Thank you for joining us to learn about some more TEK and ecological succession. And thanks also to our guest expert, Pon Dixon. He is a wealth of knowledge. We hope you're more inspired to get outside and start searching for examples of ecological succession yourself. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and write a review if you enjoyed it. Also, find more information about the species we found and more resources for naturalists by following us on social media and our website, lucec.loyno.edu. Our introduction music is composed by Loyola Popcom graduate Hunter Wainwright, and this episode was produced by Emma Reed. Until next time.